You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Firefighters Local 42 and Bricklayers and Allied Craft Workers Local 15. Greater Kansas City Firefighters Local 42 is an affiliate of the International Association of Firefighters. We are your firefighters, EMS professionals, communication specialists, prevention and logistical support members within the Greater KC Metro region. We support labor and labor education that is provided by this program. And in unity, there is strength. Please support workers' rights. Bricklayers and Allied Crafts Local 15, Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, earlier this year, the Missouri legislature passed a bill aimed at gagging and crippling the unions that represent public employees at the state and local level. Unions like the Firefighters Local 42, as a matter of fact. This week on the Heartland Labor Forum, we'll talk to attorney John Boyd on the court cases which unions have filed against the new law. And before that, Eric Loomis has written a new book, A History of America in 10 Strikes. It places the struggle for worker justice at the heart of American history. In the news? Not again. Republicans plan to reintroduce right to work to Missouri. And is the new NAFTA any better than the old one? Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Aereo, and her stories are 1, just doing their job and now they're dying for it, 2, workplace violence isn't something that just happens, and 3, big OSHA fines slashed for Blue Springs, Missouri company. And now for the news.
And this is the news from our side, December 13th, 2018. December 13th? December 6th, 2018. I don't know. After much asking, the Trump administration has finally released its White House Task Force Postal Service report, and American Postal Workers President Mark Demenstein made a swift response. He said, if the report was assigned a zip code, it would be 00000. This poorly conceived report makes many of its recommendations based on myth and misinformation that instead of improving mail services, we would deliver higher prices and less service for the public. He continued, the facts are the public postal service serves each and every person. According to recent surveys by Gallup and the Pew Research Center, it enjoys the highest level of satisfaction and trust of any government or service or agency. The United States has the lowest postage rates in the industrialized world. USPS doesn't take a penny in tax dollars and under the universal service mandate delivers to 157 million addresses 6 days a week at affordable prices. This report calls for slashing universal service. Recommendations would slow down service, reduce delivery days, and privatize large portions of the public postal service. Most of the report's recommendations, if implemented, would hurt business and individuals alike. Demenstein thinks Wall Street and their enablers have their eyes on privatizing the Postal Service because it's well suited for the e-commerce revolution. But the report didn't go that far. It stopped short of recommending privatization. He thinks the task force want to position the Postal Service for sale to private interests. He promised that the APWU will continue to strongly advocate for a robust public postal service and the rights of the hundreds of thousands of dedicated public servants that move the mail every day. The report recommends taking away the postal union's ability to negotiate wages, a clear recommendation for cutting labor costs and thus the jobs or standard of living of workers.
Last Friday in Buenos Aires, Trump, Peña Nieto, and Trudeau signed the new NAFTA, a.k.a. the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA. Implementation still has to be approved by each country's Congress or Parliament, and it won't go into effect until 2020. Trump says it renegotiated NAFTA, but according to the PII, Labor News, Mexico and Canada would say he jammed it down their throats. It also has unknown enforcement strength, and at least the AFL-CIO wants it changed and is pressuring Democrats in the new Congress to force renegotiations because, said Celeste Drake of the AFL-CIO, unenforced rules are not worth the paper they are written on. For that reason and more, the AFL-CIO is reserving judgment on the pact right now. Drake warned that just like the old NAFTA, the new one could continue the same job drain, which is now calculated by the Economic Policy Institute to have reached 851,700 factory jobs. Drake, along with Teamsters Legislative Director Mike Dolan, testified at the International Trade Commission, which will write a report to Congress on the new NAFTA. All others who testified were business lobbyists. Labor appears to be somewhat divided. Some United Auto Worker leaders want NAFTA scrapped entirely, not rewritten. Drake was quite critical of the new NAFTA, and the Teamsters find a few things to like in it and much to oppose. Trump is touting the fact that the new NAFTA, unlike the old one, has worker rights written into the body of the agreement, and for some auto workers in Mexico, it requires increased wages. Drake lauded inclusion of worker rights, but said enforcement reminded her of the weak Central America Free Trade Agreement with no teeth. She wants the stronger standards of the International Labor Organization included. Drake said NAFTA is a failure. That failure will continue unless the U.S. shifts gears and puts workers, not corporations, first in bargaining such free trade pacts, including the new NAFTA. She cited other problems in enforcement, dispute settlement, the fact that Mexican industry has world-class productivity yet falling wages. Mexican manufacturing workers earn on average less than one-fifth of manufacturing workers in the United States, and that wage gap has remained steady for 30 years, despite the wage stagnation in the U.S. Low wages obviously hurt Mexican workers and their families, but they also hurt American and Canadian workers. Also, more than half of Mexicans live below the nation's poverty line, and they can't buy U.S.-made goods. Since the new NAFTA demands detailed changes in Mexican labor laws to eliminate employer-dominated unions, Drake thinks that the U.S. should withhold trade benefits until those laws are changed. Finally, there are no labor-specific monitoring or enforcement provisions. As a result, the AFL-CIO has serious doubts the improved rules will make a meaningful difference to North American working families without additional provisions assuring funding and implementing language. Therefore, she concluded, we continue to push for improvements for the labor provisions within the text of the NAFTA as well as in domestic law in order to consider these gains meaningful.
Senator Eric Burleson of Southwest Missouri pre-filed a bill this week to reenact right to work despite its overwhelming repudiation by voters last August. St. Louis Channel 5's I-Team has learned that it's not just the legislative branch looking to implement right to work again. There's been a concerted effort within the executive branch as well. Before the August election even took place, high-level officials within Governor Mike Parson's office began looking at how to get around the anticipated loss of Prop A. Their plans are spelled out in nearly 80 pages of often redacted documents obtained by Five on Your Side, through a public records request. For example, on August 6, just one day before the primary, Governor Parsons' policy director, Kayla Hahn, sent an email to his chief of staff, Aaron Willard. In it, she predicated right to work would be rejected by voters. She said, "Missouri legislation rarely survives voter referendums." However, the memo's very title already proposed a solution, right to work by county ordinance. Hahn goes on to discuss how municipalities in other states, such as Illinois, New Mexico, Delaware, and Kentucky, have passed the law locally, including details of the legal battles that followed. She also provided links to model ordinances and model language for public and private sectors that have been developed by the American Legislative Exchange Council, an organization sponsored by the Koch brothers. Another email from July shows Willard requesting that a staff member research and report how Kentucky counties managed to enact right to work before it finally passed there at the state level. In some counties, it would simply be a majority vote of the people living within that county. And in some counties, for instance, with multiple commissioners, it could be done simply with a majority vote of the commissioners at the county level, said Greg Keller, a Republican strategist. On July 31st, that staff member writes, "We may consider drumming up a municipality in Missouri to pass a right-to-work ordinance." That same email came with an offer from an attorney for the Illinois Policy Institute who might potentially take a pro bono case for a municipality in Missouri. Other emails show Parsons staffers assembling a chart to determine which Missouri counties would be the best test case. According to public records, Parsons' executive team has identified 14 Republican stronghold counties that they believe would be good candidates for right to work at the county level. On Wednesday, Governor Parsons was asked about this, but said it's too early to say what form it might take. So is it legal? Isn't it preempted by federal law? A Kentucky court has said no, but an Illinois court said yes. It's probably headed for the U.S. Supreme Court. News Tonight was read by Judy Ansel, and I'm Jen Zaman.
Listen up, we've got a war zone here today, right in our heartland. And across the USA, these multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true. But they've declared a war on us, fight back, it's up to you. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling the shots.
Hey, this is Kim Claus. Have you ever taken an American history class? How about a labor history class? Can you imagine a world where they're the same thing? Author and labor historian Eric Loomis, in his new book, A History of America in 10 Strikes, places the struggle for worker justice at the heart of American history. He challenges all of our contemporary assumptions around labor, unions, and American workers. From the Lowell Mill Girls' strike in the 1830s to the present day, he lifts the curtain on workers' struggles, giving us a fresh perspective on American history from the boots up. I recently had a chance to talk to Eric Loomis about this eye-opening book. Eric Loomis, thank you so much for being with me today on the Heartland Labor Forum.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, Eric, why this particular book? How did A History of America in 10 Strikes come about?
Yeah, you know, I think that it's necessary to, you know, rethink how the stories we tell ourselves about American history. And, you know, one of the stories, we tell ourselves many stories as a society. Some are true, some are less true, but I think we don't often tell a story about America as a whole that centers the experience of work and working class struggle. And so what I thought I would do is, you know, ask the question, what does America look like if you center workers at the core of the history? What if the struggles and failures and successes of workers that help define American history? And so that's what this book attempts to do, is to examine American history from the perspective of workers, place workers at the center of the story, and see how it changes our history. And I think it demonstrates many things about our history, some of which are about, you know, the glory of worker struggle, and some of which are about some of the problems of America, including race and sexism and a government that is often not favorable to everyday people. And so I think writing a book like this sort of refocuses our overall narrative of America. Hopefully gives people a different perspective about the country.
Yeah, it sure did with me. There's a lot to cover in your book, but I'd really like to start with a chapter called Slaves on Strike. And for me, anyway, this chapter really expands the scope of what I would have considered labor history. So can you talk a little bit about the slaves, the Civil War, and what you refer to as the biggest labor strike in American history?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that so often when we, even for labor people, when we think about work, we often think about unions and we think about industrial work, but, you know, the foundation of everything in America, the foundation of our society, and really the foundation of European conquest of the Americas going all the way down to Argentina, was slavery. That the point of the conquest was to have people of color, originally indigenous people, Native Americans, and then African Americans, labor for free for white people. And that is the foundational economy of the colonization of the Americas by Europeans. And it's the foundation of much of the American economy when the United States becomes an independent nation in 1776. Not only slavery in the South, but much of our northern fortunes and early industrialization is based both on the cotton produced by those slaves, and on shipping and other merchants in places like where I live here in Rhode Island. That money came off of the slave trade. I mean, it was New Englanders who owned those ships that were taking slaves from Africa and delivering them to Charleston or New Orleans or wherever. And, you know, the point of slavery, we usually think about slavery in terms of racism, and I guess it's a racist system, but the point is a labor system. That the point of it is to have a fully controlled labor force for eternity. Well, during this, you know, so like other workers, and slaves were workers, slaves will rise up and fight for their dignity in any possible way that they can. And during the Civil War, what happens is that almost as soon as the war begins, as Northern troops go into various parts of the South, these slaves begin to appear on Union lines. And the Union soldiers, the generals, are not really sure what to do, but they begin to basically say, well, if this is property, if people are property, it's a law of war that we can confiscate property, so I guess you can come here. And this just decimates the South. Right, because if any time where Union troops go, these slaves leave the plantation. And what does that do? It takes away the labor from the South. It takes away the people growing the cotton or making the munitions and guns and other things that the Southern Confederates were dependent upon for their, you know, when they committed treason in defense of slavery. And by the end of the war, you have tens of thousands of slaves fleeing to Union lines, notoriously as William Tecumseh Sherman is marching through Georgia, a man who's doesn't really even care about slavery, and he finds himself overwhelmed by these thousands of slaves that follow him. In 1935, the pioneering black scholar and co-founder of the NAACP, W.E.B. Du Bois, identifies this as a general strike, and he's absolutely correct. And we need to center the experience of African Americans in our labor history generally, because that is the truest working class in America. And we have to think about slavery in terms of a labor system. And if we look at it that way, slaves striking to win the Civil War, which really moves the ball in the North, forces Lincoln toward the Emancipation Proclamation, is the most significant labor action in all of American history. And yet we usually don't even talk about it as such.
Well, and it also means, I mean, and this is another thing that's said in your book, is that they freed themselves.
That's right. I mean, I think that too often there's a story about, you know, Abraham Lincoln sitting in D.C. and deciding out of the goodness of his heart to free the slaves. And look, I mean, Lincoln was a great president, and I'm not going to say anything bad about him. I mean, the Emancipation Proclamation was a brave act still when he announced it in 1862. But that only happens because slaves themselves take their lives into their own hands. And slaves themselves force Lincoln to figure out what is the post-Civil War world going to look like. And these slaves had their demands. I mean, I think one thing about the Civil War is that there's really four big sectors of American society. Three of them know what the war is about. Southern whites sure know what the war is about slavery. Slaves know the war is about slavery. And Northern blacks know the war is about slavery. Northern whites are not really sure. That's a big part of the early history. It was slaves themselves and their action that forced people like Abraham Lincoln to understand what this war was really about.
It's a really amazing way to look at it. So race and gender issues are recurring themes in our history as workers and as Americans, and you highlight these issues in your book. Can you talk a little about why they are central themes, like in your book?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of times, you know, people, especially on the left, they often ask, you know, why do these workers, by which they usually mean white workers, why do they vote against their interests? You know, and this is a common thing. You know, they vote for politicians that don't represent working people. They are plutocrats. They are Donald Trump, right? They're people who are, you know, wealthy people who are looking to make the wealthy more wealthy at the cost of the everyday worker. Why do people vote for them? And the answer is that everyday people are voting for their interests, that we as individuals are made up of many different identities. We have a racial identity. We're white or black or Native or Asian or Latino. We have a gender identity, a religious identity. All of these different experiences and identities make up the person that we are. And yes, we have a class identity too. But these are sometimes competing notions. And very often in American history, one of the biggest problems, if we want to ask why were American unions and workers not more radical, one of the biggest issues is that white workers consistently through American history have aligned with employers and the wealthy around issues of white identity and prioritize that over their working class identity. In other words, white workers will seek to hurt other workers of color, and in a diverse nation that hurts us. And so, you know, one thing I always like to tell audiences when I speak is that the first major national legislation that comes out of the labor movement is the Chinese Exclusion Act, which came out of the California labor movement. And that's very telling. Too often, workers have allowed themselves to be divided by race and divided by gender. And meanwhile, if we look at the actual history of work, women and people of color have always been central to it. You know, so chapter one in the book focuses on the wool mill girl strikes. Chapter two is on the slave general strike, as we talked about. And we have to look at that the working class is not just white men in unions, but is rather the workers as a whole. They all have different experiences, and too often we have allowed ourselves to be divided by race and gender rather than uniting around class. And so I think that by emphasizing this and by not sort of smoothing over the warts of American labor history, but rather exposing the problems that American workers have had for what they really are, I hope to stimulate a conversation about how we don't do this in the future.
If you're just joining us, this is Kim Claus with the Heartland Labor Forum, and today I'm talking with Eric Loomis, author of A History of America in 10 Strikes. So, Eric, unions have moved through different eras. You know, they've been through times of fighting for social justice, fighting racism in the workplace, like you said, but also, you know, fighting racism within their own organizations, corporate and government attacks. How has the labor movement shaped and or mirrored the attitudes in our country as a whole?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I mean, I think that, you know, it's not coincidental that the only period in American history where workers have had a strong voice in American society is when unions were strong. And now that unions aren't strong anymore, that they've been attacked, that they've lost that, you know, that we're losing that voice, and that voice is being taken over by plutocrats and the wealthy. And I think that, you know, I think that absolutely you can really chart much of American history through the rise and fall of unions. You know, in our earlier period where unions were weak, you had high levels of income inequality, you had, a labor movement often divided by race and immigration and things like that. You know, in the 1930s, the radicalism of workers is what really forces the New Deal to become a government program that helps working class people through Social Security, through the National Labor Relations Act, through the Fair Labor Standards Act, creating a minimum wage and overtime and the 8-hour day. And all of these things are things that are created by an organized workers' movement. And an organized workers' movement and the continued demands that workers made on employers and on the government, you know, in the post-war period leads to things like, employer-subsidized health care. It leads to vacation. It leads to all kinds of benefits, pensions, and all of these things that would have been unthinkable for the working class of 70 or 80 years before that. And so I think that, you know, the union movement, when it's strong, is shaping America for the better. And now that it's been, you know, engaged in or has been suffering from decades of attacks, really going back to the 1980s with Ronald Reagan firing the air traffic controllers, which was what I focus on in Chapter 9 of the book, you know, not surprisingly, labor movement unable now to organize large numbers of American workers and make those demands, is reflected in a society where a democracy is failing, a society where inequality is rising, and a society where I think people are really beginning to look to more radical options as the old ways of creating a more equal America are falling by the wayside. So I think you can really chart much of American history through the rise and fall of unions.
And you said in A History of America in 10 Strikes that we are in the new Gilded Age, which really gave me chills after reading the rest of the book. Talk a little bit about the Gilded Age and what makes this the new Gilded Age.
Yeah, so the Gilded Age was a period of the late 19th and early 20th century that is a period that is defined by gargantuan wealth and monopoly, but great suffering among workers. It's defined by the state and employers coming together to use the power of both to crush worker organizations. So it's so often employers will demand and get state security forces, the National Guard, the U.S. military, to serve as strike-breaking force. It's a period of extremism. It's a political extremism and violence. It's a period of a great racial violence. It's a period of misogyny. It's a period of political inequality where the wealthy control our politics. It's a period where the courts and Congress serve the interests of the wealthy. And if that sounds a lot like today, there's a reason for that. So, in the Gilded Age, which I focus on in chapters 3 and 4 and 5 of the book, I highlight these strikes that demonstrate the role of the state in shaping the ability of workers to succeed, how employers use state security forces to crush worker movements, and the great struggles and the sacrifices, oftentimes deadly sacrifices that workers made to make a better life for themselves. And, today we increasingly find ourselves in that boat. Earlier this year in the Janus decision, where the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that public sector workers had to be nationally right to work, and workers could opt out of those organizations and not pay into not pay into those organizations and pay their fair share fees. It was a ridiculously argued decision. It was a decision that has very little basis in the Constitution. In oral arguments, Justice Anthony Kennedy actually stated as part of his argument a long rant about how he felt the government union cost taxpayers too much money. Well, we can debate the policy effects of that, but I don't see what that has to do with the Constitution. It has nothing to do with the Constitution.
Absolutely.
And much like a century ago in Janus, the Supreme Court, was a creation of new doctrine to undermine anything that we unions do that's effective. And it very much reminds me of how the court of a forgotten Supreme Court justice named Melville Fuller, who's most famous for the Plessy versus Ferguson decision that legalized Jim Crow segregation, was also issuing all sorts of horrible decisions that basically took laws that had nothing to do with unions and applied them against unions. And this is the reality of what we're facing today, a government that's so openly hostile to unions that the ability of workers to succeed will likely be severely undermined by these courts. And it's a real problem that we face. And workers didn't give up then, and they're not going to give up now. But these are real problems that we face, and it all comes back to these broad income inequality and the ability of the rich to dominate society like they did back in 1900.
Yeah, I can really attest to the whole public sector union thing. I work for AFT Local 691 here in Kansas City. So we deal with, of course, been dealing with the Janus decision, but we've also been dealing with horrible, horrible attacks, from our state legislature. It's been pretty frightening what they do to public sector workers. I just, in the past, could never have imagined a life where teachers were the demons. I just don't get it.
Yeah. Well, it's open warfare. I mean, anytime Republicans take power now, it's open warfare on unions, and they're pretty open about, they're not hiding the fact that they want to return the nation to what it was like in 1890, and that should scare anybody who knows anything about the past. That's a terrible time for everyday people, and that's the goal of the Republican Party.
Absolutely. So, what now? What can we learn from where we've been, and can you give us any hope?
Well, sure. I mean, I think there's all kinds of wonderful work going on today. I think that in a post-Occupy America, I think that moment of Occupy Wall Street really began to refocus the Americans on the realities of income inequality. And it takes time to build a movement. Successful movements don't happen overnight. And I think that in those 7 or so years, since Occupy was a big thing, I think we've seen the fruits of that. I think we've seen inequality being talked about in a way that had not been talked about before. We're seeing real policy proposals come forward that are much more egalitarian, things like free college, things like a $15 minimum wage. I mean, these are real parts of many people in the Democratic Party now support these kinds of things where they did not before. Even more radical things like a government guaranteed job, which was a big part of the policy debate of the 1970s, has been revived, and senators such as Kirsten Gillibrand and Bernie Sanders and Cory Booker have all come out in favor of some form of the idea that the government should guarantee you work if you can't find it. And I think that I think we're in a moment where people are really preparing to defend the remaining workers' rights from these conservatives and demand new kinds of workers' rights. And so I am optimistic about the grassroots organization going on the ground. I think it's a wonderful thing, for instance, that unions now are very pro-immigrant by and large. That was a big problem in much of American history, is unions were anti-immigrant, but and now unions are very pro-immigrant, which is a huge part of the American working class in many, many communities, including my own here in Rhode Island. And all of these things, I think, are building toward a real resistance to what's going on. They have a head start. The haters of unions or the haters of workers, they have a multi-decade head start, and they have a lot of power and money. But the struggle of workers is not only going to continue, but it's going to expand. And so I am actually, I'm not hopeful in terms of what the Supreme Court's going to do, but I am hopeful about the future of the demands and the future of the workers' movement and the kinds of the kinds of change it has the potential to make going forward.
Well, and I can't believe this, but we're already out of time. So, again, the book is called A History of America in 10 Strikes, and I really enjoyed it. Eric Loomis, thank you again for being with me today on the Heartland Labor Forum.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a real honor.
Eric Loomis is an associate professor of history at the University of Rhode Island. He writes on labor, politics, and the environment at the blog Lawyers, Guns, and Money. His work has also appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Dissent, and the New Republic. The author of Out of Sight and Empire of Timber, he lives in Providence, Rhode Island.
Most times, KKFI moves against the stream, but just saying play KKFI to your smart speaker will bring our stream to you.
What's that sound, you ask?
It's the sound of one-time-use trash. People get bottled water because of hydration, convenience, and the claim of better taste and quality. Truth is, there's usually no difference between bottled and tap water. The healthier choice is to get a cool, reusable bottle made of lined aluminum, steel, glass, or special plastic that won't break off chemical bits like the plastic used in disposable bottles. Get healthy and keep your world from becoming a big junk pile. Disposables dead. Brought to you by J.C. Herman High School and 90.1 FM KKFI.
And welcome back to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Sean Saving. Working people in Missouri earned a significant victory last August when voters overwhelmingly overturned Prop A, the supposed right-to-work law that the legislature had passed in 2017. While we should all feel proud of the work done to send such a strong message to our elected representatives to leave unions alone, that was not the only bill that the legislature has passed recently that attacks workers and their unions. Though it would seem that private sector workers have been given a reprieve, at least for now, Missouri's public sector workers have not been so lucky. Last session, the legislature enacted House Bill 1413, aimed at curtailing the rights and activities of public employees from the state down to the city level. Though the law does not outlaw public employees' unions per se, its provisions are so draconian that many argue it could spell the end of public sector unions in Missouri. Of course, like the good troublemakers they are, workers aren't taking this lying down. Joining us tonight to talk about these new restrictions and how public employees are fighting back is John Boyd, attorney for the plaintiffs that are suing to stop implementation of one aspect of the law, the provision that bans picketing. John, welcome to the show. First, can we talk about your specific case, and then we'll get to some of the other issues in the law and the court cases that have been filed on those. So your case is involving this ban on picketing, or even informational picketing, I guess, is included in this. So can you explain what that means and what's going on there?
Sure, and thanks for having us here tonight. It's always a pleasure to be back. We filed an action in Jackson County Circuit Court on behalf of two 911 dispatchers. They work for the county in the sheriff's department, and as such. They are members of the CWA Local 6360. Their contract is up this month, and they planned to commence negotiations. So the provision in the statute that is objectionable in restrains, we sought to restrain and enjoin the state of Missouri, the Jackson County Sheriff, and Jackson County as the employer from enforcing the following provision that bars picketing of any type in any collective bargaining agreement, further that such new collective bargaining agreement or memorandum of understanding had to include that language. Moreover, any public sector union member who engaged in picketing over personnel issues would be subject to immediate termination. So this means that if outside these radio offices, people were enraged over the way that children were being separated from their parents on the border and engaged in informational picketing, a public sector employee, such as the two plaintiffs in our action, mm-hmm. would be barred from participating in any picketing or informational exchange on that issue, which has nothing to do with their employment.
So even outside of their employment, this bans basically them using their rights as a citizen of the United States to protest their government.
You typically take less pay working for municipalities and state government, but you do it out of a sense of patriotism and certainly part of the reasons why you do that. And so in order to do it, the state is essentially saying you have less rights than that of your neighbors for the privilege of working for less pay and less coverage and benefits as a state or public sector employee.
Wow. And just for some of our non-labor listeners, an informational picket is say, not necessarily a strike picket, but if you just wanted to hand out flyers to your coworkers during negotiations, sort of let them know about a meeting, let them know about the issues, things like that, that's considered an informational picket. That's also forbidden in this provision?
The way it's written, all picketing is forbidden. And recently, some of the members of the union on their own time stood on public ground and passed out information how wages that Jeff Bezos is paying people who work for Amazon to push boxes will be paid $15 an hour, and the people who save lives as 911 dispatchers in Jackson County are paid $12 an hour.
Wow. And so that would – and that's illegal. That would be grounds for discipline or termination under this new provision.
Termination.
Wow. Wow. So let's – some of our listeners are probably familiar with what is known as the Janus decision. That was the recent Supreme Court ruling that said public employees cannot be forced to pay what's called a fair share fee. Those are the proportion of union dues that non-members must pay to cover their share of the cost of union representation in contract negotiation. So essentially this means that now all public employees across the country can free ride on a union contract. So essentially right to work is now the law of the land when it comes to public employees. But interestingly enough, that case was decided on a free speech issue. And can you – so – How is this case going to play into your arguments on this issue?
All right. In our case, here in Jackson County, we have a state court judge who follows Missouri law and U.S. Supreme Court law. The Janus decision said that the Illinois law that required Mr. Janus to pay fair share dues violated his constitutional right of free speech and forced or compelled speech by requiring that payment. We took that case and said you can put the boot up the backside of Mr. Janus, or you can put the boot on the throat of the public sector employee, and it, in either case, restricts free speech. Judge Jim Knatzer heard our case and at first entered a temporary restraining order, restraining that part of the law from being enforced, saying that it was unconstitutional. We thereafter obtained from Judge Knatzer what's called a temporary injunction, and next week we'll have the hearing that leads to what we're seeking, which is a permanent injunction that agrees or states that this provision is unconstitutional as to these individuals. Then if that case is appealed, then it will, assuming it's affirmed, in our view, it would mean any public employee would be protected from termination or discrimination on the basis of their exercise of free speech.
Yeah, using their rights of free speech. Now, this is a state case, so this would have to travel to the state courts. And is this something that could eventually make it into the Supreme Court at the federal level, or is this something that the state court has the final say in this?
Well, I never say never. There is another case that's pending in St. Louis by some of labor unions as plaintiffs.
Mm-hmm.
And in that action, they have taken the entire bill and challenged virtually all of it on constitutional grounds. We can talk some more about that in a little bit if you wish, but the essence is, if that case goes up and ours goes up on appeal, then you have the potential for the Eastern District as well as the Western District Courts of Appeal deciding that case and or deciding to push that to the Missouri Supreme Court, which then has ultimate decision-making authority. And since we have only focused on Missouri constitutional issues and not federal mm-hmm. constitutional issues, I would be remiss if I said that it would definitely not go to the Supreme Court.
Right.
But I can't fathom it going to the U.S. Supreme Court.
All right, okay. Well, I want to remind our listeners, this is the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Sean Saving, and I'm talking with Attorney John Boyd about Missouri House Bill 1413. A draconian anti-union law that passed earlier this year that could spell the end of public sector unionism in this state. So we talked about how they put a gag basically on public employees. They can't picket. They can't even hand out flyers about issues that are affecting their workplace. But this law goes actually at the heart of the very existence of a union, and that's the certification process. So that's the process by which a union becomes and then remains the authorized bargaining unit, bargaining representation for entity for the employees. So there's like a voluntary recognition. There's also the way you can vote in a union. How does this law change just the recognition of a union in the first place?
All right. First, I should say that this law exempts police and fire unions. However, we have several different unions, like in Jackson County. I think the carpenters may have two people who work for the county as carpenters, so they would be affected, for example.
Mm-hmm.
All right, the recognition issue. Frequently, if you have 30% or greater number of cards designating your union as my representative, an employer can obviously fight that or can voluntarily recognize that union as the sole bargaining authority for the employees, and that happens often, or it did.
Mm-hmm.
This law says that voluntary recognition of covered public sector unions is specifically prohibited. So it may be obtained only by an election by which 50% plus one of every member of the bargaining unit votes for representation. That doesn't mean 50 plus one of those who vote. it means every member.
Right. And to our listeners, that's sort of the railroad union model. Some of our union people will know this if you're in that industry, is that you need 50% plus one of all the members, not just those that vote, to certify a union. So they're changing the rules of the vote. They're preempting. I mean, that's a preemption of local control, right? I mean, that's another case where the state is saying to the local government, you can't voluntarily recognize a union. You know, you're taking away the control by the local entity, like county or school district, I guess, or city.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because I thought the party that was in power wants less government intrusion.
Yeah, yeah.
The point about the recognition that creates an immediate problem is this bill became effective August 28th. And so it's silent as to whether it applies to those who have been voluntarily recognized before that date and have not gone through the recertification process with the State Board of Mediation. And that means that there's a risk or danger that there is no authorized bargaining unit come August 28 if they had been voluntarily recognized. We don't believe that harsh result should occur, but it is a risk and it is unclear.
And so for the unions that say there's unions out there that weren't voluntarily recognized, they voted themselves in, they have to also now reauthorize like every 2-3 years, is it? They have to actually recertify?
Yes. For those, the first recertification election has to occur within a year of August 28, 2018.
Oh. And so then all of them have to recertify within the next 7 months.
Yes. And then every 3 years thereafter, within 2 weeks of the anniversary date of their initial certification. Except that, and there's a lot of buts.
And police and fire was excluded. And,
yes. And then there's also, if you have a collective bargaining agreement that expires before August of 2020 or after, then different rules apply. But the essence is, when you recertify, you have to have an election. And if you don't have 50 plus 1% of everyone who is a registered member, then you are decertified. And if you are decertified at that time, or you're no longer recognized, then you have difficulty obviously becoming recognized.
That's a lot of pressure on a union to try and stay viable with that kind of a requirements on certification. There's also restrictions on how dues now are to be collected. I mean, if that's not enough, they're going after the way dues are collected and what dues can be used for. Is that right?
Yes. You used to be able to simply, when you would sign the card, you could have an annual dues check off, and then it would have to be revoked by you if you didn't want that done. Now it has to be annually recertified, and if you don't annually recertified for dues or other fees that a member would pay, this is prohibited, and then you get in trouble.
Wow.
Both civil and potential criminal penalties.
There's so much going on here. We're getting close on time, but there's changes to the ratification process, right, of a contract. There's no binding arbitration is allowed.
Essentially, if you represent management and I represent the union and we come to terms, or what we think are terms, then I have to present it to my members. Then my members have to initially ratify it, and then I have to give it to you. And then you can decide, well, wait a minute, we don't think that we want to agree to all that just yet. So it's crazy.
Wow. It hardly seems constitutional from the sense that the Missouri Constitution actually guarantees right to union membership. Is that part of the argument that's going to be made in the St. Louis case? That, I mean, this is in the Constitution of the state of Missouri?
Yes. Article 1, Section 29 of the Missouri Constitution provides that all public employees shall have the right to collectively bargain. We believe that House Bill 1413 abrogates, eliminates, pees on, does anything that you can think that's bad, does it to public sector workers and their unions.
That, yeah, it does seem on the face of it that there's no way that's this is a constitutional bill. Well, you know, John, thank you. We are out of time. Thank you for being on the show. We are definitely going to keep track of this issue going forward over the next few months. And we appreciate your work on this. And keep us informed of what you find out. I'm sure we'll hear from you and see it in the press. Thanks again for being on the show.
Thanks for the invitation and for the ability to participate. To all my brothers and sisters, season's greetings. Happy holidays.
Thank you.
This is Mary Ario for Safety First. First, just doing their job, and now they're dying for it. From the Knoxville News Sentinel, November 8th, and the Confined Space Newsletter, November 11th, at jordanbarrett.com/confinedspace. Just before Christmas 2008, a dike at the Tennessee Valley Authority Kingston Fossil Fuel Power Plant gave way, carrying away houses and smothering 300 acres of land under a billion gallons of coal ash slurry, a byproduct of coal combustion. Construction workers from East Tennessee and across the nation responded, but without any protection or training, despite the fact that coal ash contains a concentrated stew of toxins, including arsenic, radioactive material, mercury, and lead. Today, more than 30 workers who cleaned up the spill are dead, and more than 250 are sick or dying. Testimony showed Jacobs Engineering began watering down both safety testing and worker safety rules as soon as the Environmental Protection Agency allowed the TVA to put Jacobs in charge of the site. The EPA wanted the workers to be protected with respirators and protective coveralls, but both TVA and Jacobs pressured the agency into allowing laborers to work without protection. Workers were told they could eat a pound of coal ash each day without harm. After they started getting sick, workers took videos of mishandling of air samples by Jacobs technicians. The workers sued Jacobs Engineering. The good news, if there is any, a jury in U.S. District Court spent 5 hours deliberating before returning a verdict November 7th in favor of hundreds of blue-collar laborers who say they were sickened during the cleanup of the nation's largest coal ash spill. The panel ruled Jacobs failed to exercise reasonable care in keeping workers safe and in its failures likely caused poisoning by coal ash. The verdict means workers will now get a chance to seek damages, including money to cover medical testing for all laborers who worked at the site and medical treatment for themselves and their families. Next, workplace violence isn't just something that just happens. From www.publichealthnewswire.org, November 13th. During a session on workplace violence at the American Public Health Association annual meeting, presenters shed light on the troubling fact that about 2 million Americans each year are victims of workplace violence, according to the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. The healthcare industry in particular is home to disproportionate levels of workplace violence, and nurses endure a huge share of such abuse. Many nurses report their employer's zero-tolerance policies against workplace violence don't have much clout. Workplace violence, especially as it relates to the nursing field, is a systemic issue, said Jane Thomason, National Nurses United in Oakland, California. Systemic level changes that lead to fewer resources and lower staffing levels often put nurses at higher risk of experiencing violence on the job. Her organization was instrumental in getting California to adopt an occupational health standard on workplace violence in the healthcare sector. The challenge now is getting employers to actually comply. Finally, Big OSHA fines slashed for Blue Springs, Missouri company. From the November 30th Kansas City Star at www.kansascity.com, the initial fine imposed on Aero Plumbing LLC for letting employees risk their lives in unprotected trenches, even after a worker suffocated beneath tons of loose soil, has been slashed by two-thirds. The $714,000 penalty that OSHA initially imposed on Aero Plumbing, renamed R2 Plumbing LLC, was one of the 10 largest for workplace safety violations against any company last year. The agency initially fined Arrow Plumbing $294,000 in connection with the December 15, 2016 death of 33-year-old backhoe operator D.J. Meyer, whose body was recovered from the bottom of a 12-foot trench in Belt, Missouri. Another $420,000 in penalty were levied after an OSHA inspector caught another Arrow employee 1 month later working in an unshored trench in Kansas City. Arrow admitted wrongdoing, but when the high-profile case was finally settled out of court this fall, the final penalty had been lowered by nearly $500,000 to $225,000, which the company will be allowed to pay off in installments. The company must contract for 3 years with a third party, which will develop and monitor a trench safety program. Arrow must instruct employees that they can refuse to work in unsafe conditions without fear of reprisal. Also, the company must, for the next 3 years, let OSHA's Kansas City area office know each Friday where its crews will be working the following week. Those job sites will be subject to increased inspections. This is Mary Ario for Safety First.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. Empower Missouri's First Friday Forum, which is tomorrow, Friday, December 7th, is about seniors. It's called Seniors Count. And this will be at 11:30 a.m. Well, that's networking, and noon is the program. And it'll be at the Central Library, 14 West 10th Street, KCMO, in the Vault Room, which is in the basement. And bring a sack lunch. Equity Actors Reading Theater presents a one-time reading by professional actors of A Child's Christmas in Wales by Dylan Thomas. That's Sunday, December 9th, two performances at 2 p.m. and at 3:30 p.m., and it's at the Heltzberg Auditorium in the downtown central branch of the Kent City Public Library once again, and bring your kids. Explore the Foundations of American Socialism, sponsored by the Green Party, Sunday, December 9th as well, 2 to 4 p.m., at Steele's Used Books, 214 East 18th Avenue, North Kansas City. Greater Kansas City AFL-CIO monthly meeting will be Tuesday, December 11th at 5 p.m. That's a time change from the normal one, and that's at the Argosy Casino Hotel in the Malta Room. And finally, KC Democratic Socialists of America December General Meeting, Where Socialist Thought Meets Social Struggle, Monday, December 17th, 6:45 p.m. to 8:30 at SEIU Local 1, 4526 Paseo. You can find our calendar on our webpage along with archived shows and our upcoming schedule at heartlandlaborforum.org. And that's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. We're going to have the beginning of a series of mayoral forums with probably two candidates each. And they're going to be looking at the economic justice issues in the city's mayoral race. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zeman. Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI
or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.